It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. Hello, thank you for listening to the It's Going Down podcast. Today we're lucky enough to bring you a conversation we had with three anti-fascists and anarchists from the so-called United Kingdom who recently came to the United States to give a series of talks about anti-fascist organizing in the UK. We think that there's a lot of correlation between what's happening in the UK and the US, especially with the growth of the so-called alt-light, which eschews over-the-top white supremacy, flying swastika flags and all that stuff, but is still trying to gain a foothold in British society and advance a series of fascist politics which redraw the lines of who is included and who is excluded specifically within society itself. And obviously there's a lot of correlation between groups like Patriot Prayer and also the Proud Boys here in the United States. So we spent a lot of time talking about the similarities and also the differences between both the far right in the United Kingdom and the US and also anti-fascist responses to it. Thanks a lot for listening. Let's get into it. All right, thank you for tuning into the It's Going Down podcast. We have three special international guests today from the United Kingdom. Just introduce yourselves real quick.
Yeah, my name's Jim. I'm from libcom.org.
I'm Rosa, and I'm from the London Anti-Fascists.
And I'm A, and I'm from London Anti-Fascists.
So you're here in the U.S. talking about just this the situation with fascism, the far rights in the UK. I mean, there's a lot to talk about, which we will get into, especially with what's going on with Tommy Robinson, that whole situation. There's even like far right riots now in the UK. But just to kind of like lay a foundation of understanding, how do you see the differences between the far right in the UK and also just the way that white supremacy and racism have played out historically when compared to the United States, just based on whatever impression or whatever you've read, you know, at all?
Well, I think the main difference is that we don't have white supremacy in the same way it exists in the US. It's like Britain exported white supremacy around the world, but it never needed to create a white supremacist state in the UK. So it's like there's never sort of, anything like slavery happening on the same level that it did in the US. Mm. So it's like white nationalism in the UK, like, it's still a problem, it still exists, but it's not like the whole fabric of the society is based around the idea that white people should be, like, above others. It's like we still have structural racism, we still have, like, huge problems with that, but it's not sort of embedded in the institutions in the way that it seems to be in the US.
I mean, like, I think one of the interesting things that we were talking about was just how in the United States, the alt-right has this idea that all white people are, you know, spiritually connected and that, you know, they create this, like, mythical race, whereas in European countries, far-right fascists, neo-Nazis, I mean, will typically, like, for instance, in Britain, they'll hate Irish people or there'll be backlash against Polish people. So there doesn't seem to be this kind of, like, you know, kumbaya, my white brothers and sisters, you know, which is very interesting because, again, that, you know, says a lot for the American experience as well.
Well, white identity has been constructed in a different way in America. Like, there was a need in American nationalism to create, like, an oppositional group to the large domestic kind of BME population that was imported there. Whereas in Europe, national identity was often constructed against other European nations that we fought wars against. I mean, British national identity has been constructed through fighting wars against the French and the Germans and the Spanish. Like, the things that we're taught about like English history is like the Armada, the Spanish Armada, the World War II, the wars, like 100 Years Wars against the French. Like, these are things that have gone into constructing a national identity rather than a racial one.
Mm.
And it's why it's very different situation in the UK than it is in the US.
Well, I think a lot of people would just push back on that and say, well, what about the fact that Britain has colonized so many other countries? How does that affect the way that structurally people from those colonized countries are then seen in Britain, either as immigrants or people that are part of different colonies and stuff like that?
It's not necessarily a kind of a white supremacist view. It's like a British national identity has been constructed as Britain is a great nation that's ruled over these other nations, but it's very much like British, not white, and it's not like a pan-European white. In fact, when the National Front was originally set up, it had a policy of free movement within Europe, which was quickly abandoned when they realised how unpopular that was with other British nationalists. National Action had a British neo-Nazi group had a massive argument within it about whether they should support reunification of Ireland, because a lot of the older neo-Nazis had been gun running for loyalist groups and like supporting loyalist groups.
Yeah, there was actually a string of anti-immigration protests being held a couple of years ago. And Polish neo-Nazis were told that they weren't allowed to attend those protests because they're immigrants. So it's like, there is even that division within the far right.
So wait, you were saying that neo-Nazis told another group of neo-Nazis, like, hold up, you're Polish, you can't come, you're immigrants.
Yeah, yeah.
No. But it wasn't like we best not see you. It was like, we're really sorry, but this is like about immigration, and it would look really bad if we had a bunch of immigrants protesting about immigration. And the Polish neo-Nazis' like approach to being an emigre population is like interesting as well, because it's like a contradiction that they can't really sort out. And I think they try and appeal to kind of a pan-European white identity more than like British neo-Nazis ever have done.
And I mean, we might talk about this later, but how does this fit into kind of what Generation Identity is trying to construct of like a pan? Or from the U.S., it seems like a pan-European, you know, we're all white, you know, we're all European, which seems to be like a new construct.
Yeah, it's basically like their politics are relevant within the EU. So it's like they're sort of pushing this idea that, yeah, there's this pan-European identity, that they are sort of aware of, like, the ethno-nationalist sort of divides or whatever that they talk about. But there is some pushback against that from British fascists, because they're like, you're pushing this idea of like, we're all one, when really Britain is great and different. And I think that is one of the things that's going to make it difficult for them to advance. But yeah, sorry, I'm garbling.
No, the thing that they seem to be using though is that they are using the free speech rhetoric, and that has been, like, particularly with Martin Selner having been not allowed entry into the UK, and they're kind of jumping on that bandwagon as well, and that's a way that they've been able to kind of convince a lot of people in the UK, despite their like kind of white ethno-nationalist like message. That's one way in which they've kind of been able to convince followers in the UK that like they are legit, because they've been using that kind of free speech rhetoric.
Well, I think like what's been really interesting as when the far right abandoned this kind of biological racism and tried to reframe it as like a cultural identity, that like historically like different ethno groups have like a cultural identity, and it's just about a homogenization of cultural identities rather than like a biological division, between different like races. That's kind of, it's not really cut through, but you've seen the state take on that kind of argument when it comes to like immigration and integrating immigrant communities. Like there has been kind of like a kind of argument being pushed out that there is a British kind of culture, which has never really been defined, and it's never really had like any sort of like explanation as to what that is. But they've been pushing out this kind of rhetoric of like, well, we've got this British culture and we need to protect this British culture from other cultures that come in and try and like taint it, you know. That's been one of the major successes of like the far right, and things like the English Defence League has been pushing that rhetoric around a kind of cultural racism rather than a biological or anything like that.
That's why, you'll see, like, in the English Defence League, for example, it was one of the first times I started seeing non-white people in, like, as part of a far-right group. Like, when I saw English Defence League, like rallying or marching, I saw, like, some of their members were black and were Islamophobic. And they identified as British, they identified as English, and they kind of took on that national kind of identity.
It's like, well, we say that, and that is sort of definitely something that's happening. The British state is still deporting non-white British citizens. It's like the whole Windrush scandal has seen people being deported to Jamaica, like some of whom have never been there like before in their lives. So it's like there is still sort of enough structural racism in the UK that it's not fully recognising non-white people as being fully British, but non-white people themselves do see themselves as fully British. And it's like the British far right has opened itself up like to let those kind of people in. I think if fascism is ever going to take hold in the UK, it's going to be based on like nationality and citizenship rather than through like a purely racial type thing. It's like the far right aren't demanding a white ethno state in the UK. Like they're demanding that borders are shut, they're demanding that like British culture is maintained.
Yeah, they want a cultural homogenisation rather than like an ethno state, which I mean, like in reality, what that does mean is an ethno state, but like it's an interesting kind of step change for the British far right.
Right. Well, we think it's important. Like, I mean, this is something that like Gavin McInnes talks a lot about. Is like, you know, shutting the borders down, letting or forcing people to acclimate to like quote American culture. He explicitly says like, you know, basically, you know, white culture. Which to us is like, you know, it's an implicit white nationalism. It's not explicit, but it's implicitly saying like, you know, we want, you know, white supremacy and structural racism to basically be the order of the day. However, we're okay with, you know, non-whites essentially being in the same space as long as they basically bow to that regime of order. And, you know, I mean, I think all this stuff is about, you know, redrawing the lines of who's included and who's excluded. And if some people of color, if some women, and if some trans people are down for that regime, then they can basically be on the team. And that also helps these movements, you know, have tokens that they can bring out at rallies and stuff like that. And I'm sure we'll talk about that more. But just real quick, I wanted to turn back to, you know, Britain, like the United States, was obviously involved in World War II. Britain was, you know, heavily bombed by the Nazis. There's a, you know, a distinct memory of that conflict. And I'm just curious, how did British society go for that, from that experience then to dealing with somebody like Oswald Mosley, with the British Union of Fascists and the rise of that kind of like homegrown fascist movement and that kind of like first generation of anti-fascism on the streets?
If you heard of a group called the 43 Group, it was a group of Jewish ex-servicemen who'd come back from World War II, and they knew about the Holocaust, they knew everything that had happened, and they just smashed the British Union of Fascists. And there's that sort of was a kickstart of the sort of groups of militant anti-fascists coming together and taking the struggle to the far right. Like, before that, like, we had Cable Street, it was like mass community defence. But yeah, it was really the 43 Group sort of started this tradition that sort of lasted up to the current day of groups of people going out and smashing fascists.
Where did Mosley come from? Like, where did he get his funding? What kind of class interest did he represent? Like, who was kind of involved in that group? Like, where did kind of the first generation of neo-Nazis come from?
They were British aristocrats, predominantly. They were anti-communist. And it initially started with people in Britain seeing what Mussolini was doing in Italy. And the first British group, I think, was called the British Fascisti. That never really took off. It was more like Mosey. He was an MP at the time. I think, was he a Labour or Tory MP?
I think he was a Labour MP, and then he was a Tory MP, and then he set up the British Union of Fascists.
Oh, wow.
But he was like also heavily supported by the person who owned the Daily Mail. His name actually escapes me.
Lord Rothermere.
Lord Rothermere. I think he's a Viscount or something. Yeah, Lord Rothermere printed like front page articles saying hurrah for the black shirts and things like that. So it was very much like a kind of parts of the establishment at that time were kind of at war with each other, and parts of the establishment saw the kind of fascist movement as like their kind of best hope to restore order or like smash like a red menace that they saw was coalescing.
Like, while anti-communism was one of the main sort of drivers for it, it was also the decline of empire. It's like the one of the groups that set up the National Front was called the League of Empire Loyalists. So it's like that a huge thing of the British far right is like trying to maintain British superiority around the world. And it's like it's tied in with that idea of which is essentially white supremacist, but it's the way it manifests itself internally within Britain is not the same as it has done in like Australia, South Africa, Canada, or the US.
Well, because when the whole British nation, the idea of the United Kingdom was an imperialist project. Like the whole kind of national identity until very recently has been built off the idea of empire, and like the decline of empire challenged the entire British national identity. If we weren't like one of the leading empires, then who were we? Like, if British people didn't rule the waves, then who were we? And that's something that like the British state has struggled to redefine, and it's kind of hodgepodged it in with this kind of idea of like multiculturalism. Has really like fudged it.
Yeah, and I guess Ireland was Britain's first colony. And this is one of the reasons why Irish people have been like an oppressed minority within Britain. It's like, not quite so much today, but there is some sort of still residual anti-Irish racism.
Mm. And you definitely see that anti-Irish racism come back if the question of reunification of Northern Ireland was like relevant again. If there was any sort of troubles that flared up in Northern Ireland, you definitely see that become like a resurgent thing.
Although we say that Tommy Robinson's actually of Irish descent, so it's like there have been people from Irish backgrounds active within the British far right, but like most Irish people within the UK, I think, probably sympathetic towards anti-fascism.
So just moving on now, you know, when we get to the 70s and onward, we start to see groups like the National Front. We start to see the British National Party in the 1980s. How did this kind of new wave of fascist groups that seem to really have an interest in kind of like organizing or at least talking to the white working class in Britain, how did they get started?
Well, it's a continuation of the British Union of Fascists. This kind of march and grow strategy was like...
It wasn't quite.
Well, I mean, in strategy, like, formation, like, the idea was to march in, like, contentious communities.
Well, no, I think it's the new wave of immigration, isn't it? It's like the post-war Windrush thing. It's like British society started to stop being, like, entirely white. You know, the post-war is like the Windrush generation coming over. And it was partly a backlash against that. Although they were pushing the sort of the general fascist project as being against immigrants. So even before that, the Tories had been anti... the Tories had run things, you know, if you want an N-word for a neighbour, vote Labour.
Yeah.
Being like a famous conservative campaign.
Yeah.
So it's like they were trying to latch onto that kind of like anti-immigrant sentiment to push this idea of a white person. And it's like it did have some successes. It was like the National Front were incredibly violent. They terrorised migrant communities. They like attacked the left. Like there's a good YouTube video called Britain's Nazi Party about how in Leeds, like, the National Front were just going around attacking left-wing spaces, attacking anti-racists, then terrorising migrants. It's like a lot of immigrant communities lived in fear, like, in the 70s.
But that's the point, is that they wanted to build power on the streets, and they also, at the same time, wanted to, like, build power in the electoral box. They had a dual-track strategy of, like, well, if we march and we grow, then we'll build a movement that can take power. They weren't necessarily interested, like a lot of modern British fascists are, in winning elections. They were more interested in getting thousands of white people to march and take part in, like, a coming kind of fascist revolution.
Yeah, and the BNP was basically following the same strategy that the NF were until they were beaten off the streets by anti-fascists.
Right. And, I mean, I want to turn now to the history of, you know, what we would consider now modern anti-fascism. And I don't want to spend too much time on this because there's so many good books and there's so many great resources to look at. Of course, there's the book Beating the Fascists. There's different texts on people's, both anarchist and socialist and communist reflections on the 1980s. So there's a lot of stuff to read, but just if we could kind of go over the basic history of groups like Anti-Fascist Action and how that kind of led us to the Antifa movement today in the UK.
So Anti-Fascist Action was founded after a wave of struggles between left-wing and fascist paper sellers, like the tail end of the 70s. This group called Red Action were expelled from, or this group of, like, Leninist street fighters were expelled from the SWP, called Squadists. They went on to set up a group called Red Action, which is like a Leninist group. They came together with a number of different groups, like socialists and anarchists. It's like Workers' Power, a Trotskyist group, Class War, an anarchist group, Direct Action Movement, it was anarcho-syndicalist. I think a few others all came together and set up Anti-Fascist Action. And the idea of that was to combat the far right physically and ideologically. And they were hugely successful. It's like they effectively helped smash what was left of the National Front. They beat the BNP off the streets, and it actually led to the BNP abandoning street activity completely. So it's like they just became an electoral party. Like, they stood in elections. They won up to like a million votes in 2009, or just short of a million.
Yeah, it was so successful that they didn't even have a kind of an effective street movement until 2009. Like, it was the EDL that brought that back. But yeah, they smashing the BNP off the street effectively ended for a decade, like, fascist street movements.
Yeah. So then, when AFA disbanded, sort of shortly after the BNP had made that turn, Red Action pulled their support for it and set up a new group called the Independent Working Class Association. The idea being that they would combat the BNP on housing estates through sort of campaigning against like shoddy housing, that kind of stuff. When that happened, anarchists set up a group called No Platform, which lasted for a couple of years. It was anarchists and sort of socialist party members. The idea was to keep that AFA tradition of just beating up fascists going. By 2004, like, that had sort of gone into decline, so anarchists regrouped and set up a group called Antifa, which existed until 2009. And that was much of the same thing, like, going around beating up fascists. It's like, it didn't work that effectively against the BNP, but it did work really effectively against smaller far-right groups that were trying to keep that march and growth strategy going.
Well, let's talk now about the rise of the English Defense League, because I think this has a lot of correlation with what we've seen in America under Trump. Because the English Defense League, you know, at least according to the people within it, was not neo-Nazi, was not outwardly racist. It was just against radical Islam, by and large, or maybe immigrants beyond that. So how did people respond to this kind of new breed of far-right activity? What did the EDL do, and how did people respond to it?
I mean, the main opposition at that time came from a group called Unite Against Fascism.
Well, like, I think it's important to note that, like, people didn't really know what to do at the start. Like, Ian Bone, this prominent British anarchist, actually called for people to join EDL demos and be, like, an anarchist presence on them. So it's like, there was a couple of years where people...
Wait, why?
Because anarchists should be against militant Islam.
There were groups also across the country, like anarchist groups, that were saying things like, oh, they're actually just the real, like, working class, that's where the class is, so we need to go where the class is. And it was this kind of, like, weird thing where they just completely lost the plot. Just kind of, yeah, it was a crazy time.
Yeah, so it took a while for people to recognise that it was essentially a fascist street movement. So it's like, it came out that Tommy Robinson, who was the founder, had been a former BNP member. His cousin had signed the nomination, had also been in the BNP and had signed nomination papers for a BNP candidate like a couple of years before the UDL was launched. So it did have this sort of fascist past. And then also like huge numbers of British far right were taking part in its protests. It's like people doing Nazi salutes on demos. People that we knew had been active in the BNP or the National Front were taking part in its marches. And it gave
Nazis the space for them to come back onto the streets. Like, it pulled a lot of, like, people that I wouldn't necessarily define as fascists, but it gave fascists the space to, like, recuperate and bring themselves back onto the street and exist within this, like, wider movement.
Yeah, and the main way that people responded to it was by just doing large counter-protests. It was, yeah, Unite Against Fascism that was mentioned earlier, were this Trotskyist front group that were backed by parts of the government, and they were just doing counter demos. So it's like you'd have 2,000 EDL members in one part of the town centre, and then on another part of the town centre there'd be 2,000 anti-racists.
Well, I mean, to be fair to the UAF, they did to begin with have a kind of a confrontational strategy to the EDL marches. I think it changed in Bolton, I think it was in 2010. Anyway, they tried to take the EDL's demo point before they'd arrived, and it was 3,000 on each side, so 3,000, maybe 4,000 EDL, 3,500 UAF, and the police just went in, like, smashed the UAF's demo up, arrested a whole bunch of people on, like, a bunch of, like, trumped up charges. And I think that's when, like, the softer parts of the UAF just kind of put a stop to any sort of, like, confrontational direction. They were like, no, we're not having any of this anymore, we're going to try and out-legitimise? We're going to try and appear more legitimate than the EDL. We're going to try and paint the EDL as these mindless, like, football hooligan thugs, while we're going to be representative of, like, polite society. And that's how we're going to combat the EDL, and we're going to marginalise them in the press, and we're going to marginalise them in the kind of normal, quote-unquote, society. And that's the way we'll combat them, rather than any sort of attempt to kind of undermine them through street activity.
Yeah, I think it's partly because, like, British society is nominally anti-fascist because of World War II. So it's like whenever there's a far-right movement that emerges, people just want to pin the Nazi label on them. Like, and that does kind of work in some respects, because it's like people think, our grandparents support these people, like, why would we support them now? And it's like, yeah, that's one of the main things that the left is trying to do with the EDL, is just pin that label on them.
And successfully too. I mean, like, when you saw the wider layers of the EDL kind of leave it and the Nazi core kind of remained, you did find that actually, like, there were quite a few of the main organisers were members of, like, other far-right political groups.
I'm not sure I'd say that the EDL had a Nazi core. Like, I think the core of it is just, like, kind of pathetic anti-Muslim sort of activists. Because it's like, it was more like Nazis, people would get involved in the EDL and then they'd join Nazi groups.
I mean, I
you know, like, all the EDL splinter groups, like, yeah. Southeast Alliance and Northwest Infidels, they were, like, initially in the EDL. But then, because the EDL wasn't interested in, like, talking about Jews, they would break off, set up new groups. And it's like people, it was more like the EDL was a starting point for people on this, like, racist political journey.
But I think I disagree that the splinter groups were a political break. I think what it was that the organisation was falling apart and people, like, were opportunists, and they saw that this was a time to kind of claim that what was left of the street movement by, like, breaking away and pulling parts of it. And they were quite successful in some parts of the country. But, like, they had always existed as far right, kind of much further to the right than the official EDL, like, line. And when they broke away, they had complete, like, free rein to organise as such.
But there was a political tension there, where Tommy Robinson's EDL was trying to appear like it wasn't a far-right organisation. And these groups, like, there was a conflict between these groups, like, there's physical violence, like, between them, and it's, like, that's the kind of thing that anti-fascists need to be aware of and, like, looking at, because, like, they're the kind of divides that we want to force, like, when to try and break movements apart. So it's, like, I think it's important to recognise that, like, these tensions do exist within these groups, where, like, some people will want to be more extreme, others will try to be more moderate.
It's something, yes, it's just going back to what we said about the anarchist kind of initially in the EDL's initial kind of start, when it first started up, not really knowing how to deal with them, whether or not to kind of support them or whatever. A similar thing that actually happened recently with the FLA, the Football Lads Alliance, which is a group of various different football firms that have come together, uniting, like, under this banner of, like, anti-radical Islam and anti-radical extremism. And similarly, like, the anti-fascist network and various other anti-fascist groups in the UK, in its initial, like, stages, were just not sure how to respond to it. We weren't sure whether or not, actually, like, if we start challenging them, will we push them further to the right because they're not explicitly, openly, like, fascist, or actually is it in our interest to challenge them because actually they are, like, being... organised by, like, a fascist court, and there was lots of those kind of debates.
I don't think, like, originally the FLA were organised by a fascist court. Like, John Megan? Yeah, fuck knows. He didn't have this kind of historical, like, far-right baggage on it.
You say that, but his wife is Facebook friends with a woman that was on the fringes of national action.
Well...
So there may be something more than...
But, like, their big demo, like, we put spotters out into the crowds.
What
and we
spotters?
Had
explain what spotters are.
Well, we had people infiltrate the demo, and we had people in the pubs, and we had people kind of walking around. Like, there was an explicit call from the leadership. They said, like, no, like, English flags, no flags at all, no singing, no patriot songs, like, nothing that could be seen as like far right, basically. So usually in these things, like, people would at least have, like, a little pin badge, like a poppy badge or like an England, like, flag badge, because I think they think that that, like, offends the left or something for some reason. They didn't have any of that. There wasn't any singing or anything like that. So it was a markedly different animal to the EDL. And on top of that, they weren't trying to build any local branches. They weren't trying to build power in any sort of communities. They weren't trying to march in any contentious areas. Like, it was an entirely different thing to the EDL. So it was legitimate, I think, for people to question whether it was, like, a good idea to come out and oppose it straight away, because there would have been, like, an immediate pushback, and there would have been, like, an immediate swing to, like, other right-wing groups that they saw as allies.
In the United States, immigration has basically become, like, a whipping boy for, you know, the negative impacts of corporate globalization. But curious, in Britain, what is the drive to demonize, you know, so-called radical Islam? Which, I mean, obviously, you know, we're no fans of ISIS. We're no fans of reactionary authoritarian regimes of whatever religious stripe. But I'm just curious, you know, who benefits from kind of, like, putting out this narrative that society is becoming, you know, increasingly influenced by Islam, that there's, you know, Islamification. I mean, obviously there's a lot of parallels between, you know, anti-communist conspiracy theories and this, but I mean, what is this ideology of anti-Islam?
I mean, what they want to do is they want to get the most marginalized parts of, like, Islam. They want to get the most kind of, like, radical street preachers, and they want to pin that to the rest of the, like, Muslim community. When the Muslim community has actually proven time and time again that they actually want no fucking part of what, like, people like Anjem Chowdhury have, like, plans for the UK or anything like that. Like, the far right make a lot of noise about things like ISIS and, like, ISIS attacks, but like, in reality, it's anti-fascists that have been supporting, like, with fighters and stuff, the Kurdish struggle against ISIS in Syria. Like, they've, anti-fascists in the UK have done far, far more, and given their lives for the struggle against ISIS, because they see it as an extension of, like, the struggle against fascism and the struggle against other kind of reactionary ideologies.
The whole anti-Islam thing is just another example of the rich playing divide and rule, and, like, trying to pin the blame for social decay on immigrants rather than accepting that it's them making cutbacks or them failing to sort of provide funding to things that are causing the real problems. It's like we've just had like a huge, like, well, nearly 10 years of austerity, like cuts to public services, and it's like the government have just taken like millions and millions of funding away from stuff, like real wages have been declining. It's like life has been getting harder, and they're blaming it on immigrants that have been in the UK for like 20-30 years. It's like, it's fucking ridiculous.
Yeah, we have we're supposed to have one of the best healthcare systems in the world. So we've got the NHS, and we're supposed to be like very proud of it, but that's been like so like chipped away at and privatised. And you can see like at the moment, if I want to book an appointment with the doctors, I have to wait like 2 or 3 weeks till I get seen. And these are the kinds of things that people, again, like, are that the ruling class in the UK has successfully been able to blame immigrants for, and particularly like Muslims as well, because that's the kind of like space of it now. It's like going against like radical Islam is basically like, again, like a code word for like for Muslims and for anyone that's othered in that sense.
I mean, it's no accident that a lot of incidents of kind of individuals being racist happen on like things like public transport, where like there is like a kind of like everyone's like very like crammed in, like services are like being kind of like cut back. Like the railway system's like nowhere near as good as it used to be, and people are kind of like crammed in together in like a very kind of hot and tense environment, and it's kind of symbolic of like what like racists have been saying about like not having enough room for like immigrants, not having enough resources to like go around, this kind of like politics of like artificial scarcity, which the far right have often like used to pin the blame on like immigrants rather than like the government is actually creating this kind of artificial scarcity.
You know, one of the things that's marked militant anti-fascism in the UK has been a combination of forces from both socialist and anarchists. I'm curious, you know, on this show we've talked about kind of, you know, in largely a negative light of, you know, this idea of left unity. And I'm curious, in your experience, has there been a positive thing of working across kind of like ideological lines on the far left in order to, you know, engage in militant anti-fascism, or are there still kind of major problems that come out of those lines?
My experiences over the past like 15 years have been largely positive. Yeah, my experiences have been largely positive. Like, some of the best anti-fascists that I've worked with have been sort of socialists, like, even though I have sort of some Stalinist comrades that have been great anti-fascists, but these are still people I have massive political disagreements with. But it's like, if you've got tactical and an element of theoretical unity, it's like, I think it can be better than... It's like, there's some anarchists that I don't want to work with, because they just have no fucking clue about what they're doing. And it's like, some Stalinists still have a sort of class-based analysis, they have an understanding of the way capitalism works. Obviously, like, as Stalinists, they want to create a new capitalist state. They're not, like, genuinely communist. But, yeah, I think if you've got the right people, you can work together. But it depends on, like, what people are trying to do. If people are trying to be an effective anti-fascist because they recognise the far right is a threat to the entire left, it can be worth doing. If people see anti-fascism as just a way to build up their cult or their project, it's like, there's no point in working with them at all.
I mean, I'd largely agree with that, to be honest. I think as well, like, historically, there's more of a, from what I've seen in my short time in the US, there's more of a kind of historical militant anti-fascist project in the UK that has involved, like, socialists and anarchists and communists. Whereas in America, I think there's, like, a very new thing that has largely been taken up by anarchists, and I think a lot of the left kind of mistrusts it and kind of views it with suspicion. Yeah, I'd agree that the most successful kind of anti-fascist projects have been like alliances between different kind of ideological positions, like AFA, for example.
Yeah, basically the DSA are going to get fucked if they don't start putting squads out.
You know, one thing I wanted to ask is, you know, in reading the book Beating the Fascists, one of the things that comes out is that, you know, beyond, you know, obviously like street fighting and, you know, just defense of working class communities by any means necessary against fascism and racism, there were festivals, there was a cultural element, obviously there are people in the punk scene, you know, Oi, ska, all that stuff. Is that something that continues today? Is there a cultural element to anti-fascism that also is people are working on, you know, whether just popularizing certain, you know, proletarian positions or, you know, putting on festivals of music or, you know,
I mean, what is that? I think when LAF was originally set up, like one of the things that
LAF is
London Anti-Fascist was originally set up, we recognized that there was actually like a really harmful kind of link to like a subculture that narrowed our appeal. Like if all of your comrades are just organizing in the kind of cross punk scene, then you very rarely kind of look outwards to the like millions of like working class people that you potentially want to appeal to. But it all depends on what your anti-fascist project is and what the fascist project that you're targeting is. If it's largely located within a subcultural scene, then your anti-fascist movement will reflect that, you know? If it's like built amongst like the football terraces, then you'll want your anti-fascist movement to reflect that. If it's built in estates, then again, you'll want your anti-fascist movement to reflect that.
I think it partly in the past, it's been that subcultures have been where the conflict with the far right has been. It's like they've been contested spaces. And it's like anti-fascists need to be active in places where the far right are trying to organise. It's like in the past, the far right used to try to go to punk shows and like they'd do C-cars on dance floors. They'd like try and have an active presence there. And it's like that's why there was such a big response from punks in the UK. Like, it is useful to have, like, there are things happening at the moment. There's a punk and Oi festival happening in Manchester this weekend. There are left-wing anti-fascist football fans that have, like, organised fan groups. So there is a sort of a scene, like, anti-fascist cultural scene, and that's really important for maintaining anti-fascism as a movement. It's, like, people that can do prisoner support, that can raise money for anti, like, to pay for things when needed. It's like it's really important in that respect. But yeah, I think as Ava was saying, it's like it's not that integral to the anti-fascist struggle. Like as in, yeah.
Well, let's turn now to Generation Identity, who we brought up before. But how has anti-fascism? I know there was mobilizations recently in the UK, but how? Not only how do you view kind of like this new manifestation of so-called identitarianism, but you know, how are people responding to it?
I think Generation Identity are going to be a threat because they've got sophisticated online presence. They're like, for far right activists, they're fairly competent on social media, and they're going to fill a gap that National Action left. When National Action got banned, it was like an open neo-Nazi terrorist group. And I think the fact that Generation Identity aren't openly neo-Nazi, like, will mean that they'll be able to grow a bit. Like, they're going to be able, they can coexist with Tommy Robinson's sort of like anti-Muslim street movement quite easily. But they're a more sort of far right edge of that. And it's like they've got huge networks in Europe where they have buildings, like across sort of France and Germany. Like they've got a huge amount of resources. And I think once they get a proper sort of foothold in the UK, they could be around for a while. And they're going to pull people from groups like what was once the EDL. They'll pull people from the FLA. And these are groups that they're targeting at the moment. So this whole string of far-right free speech events that was sparked with Generation Identity, like, they've been out leafleting them. They've also been out leafleting the Football Lads Alliance protests. And, like, they're trying to recruit from those areas. And it's going to work. Like, they have been growing.
They're on university campuses as well. They've been coming to, like, a couple of campuses in central London, and just like stickering like transphobic and Islamophobic propaganda and stuff. And there's been like a response to it. So there's like student networks now that are like forming anti-fascist groups, which is one of the first times that we've actually seen this in quite a while as well.
I think the task for combating generation identity is to pick them apart while they're small enough to be picked apart. I think British anti-fascists should not allow a group that has the ability to grow to a point where it becomes dangerous. I think there's often like a kind of pattern with people that would consider themselves anti-fascist but not necessarily like involved in anti-fascist groups, that they ignore these small groups when they're tiny and look like a bit silly and a bit stupid, and then when they get big enough and dangerous enough to actually pose a threat, that's when they take them seriously. I think we need to have like a kind of step change and like a cultural shift within the left to actually take small groups of fascists or small groups of the far right seriously, pick them apart while it's easy to pick them apart, and then we don't have to deal with them when they're huge.
Yeah, we should be playing whack-a-mole.
Yeah.
Well, then let's just get into kind of the hot topic of the day. I mean, there was a free speech rally that Milo Yiannopoulos not from the United States. So Milo came over. There were other speakers, including Tommy Robinson. This was based around this free speech rally that happened like a month ago. This was based around the guy with the dog. It sounds so stupid to say it, but a guy with a dog, he taught his dog how to do the Nazi salute every time he saw Hitler or something like that. This is what caused this rally. So let's just talk about that. And how does this lead us up to Tommy Robinson going to prison, and why did he go to prison?
Well, this whole thing started with Generation Identity trying to get Martin Selman, who's one of the European leaders, and Brittany Pettibone, who is his American racist girlfriend, to come over to the UK where they were going to give a speech to UKIP, UKIP's youth wing. They got banned by... So UKIP being the UK Independence Party, which is this like hard right political party.
And they are fine with having a white nationalist speak in front of them?
Not completely. Like, so there have been tensions within UKIP where UKIP members have kicked off about it, accusing Generation Identity of being Nazis. But then there are other parts of UKIP who are desperate for Tommy Robinson to be allowed into the organisation. So it's like that UKIP is a contested space between like libertarians, anti-racist types, and hard right fucking pseudo-fascists.
And just to be clear, Tommy Robinson is cool with Generation Identity?
Yeah, he's... So what happened was Selma got banned from the UK. Generation Identity held a protest in Hyde Park at Speaker's Corner where they read out the speech that Selma was supposed to give. The following weekend, Tommy Robinson came. It's like 100 people turned up when it was just Generation Identity. It was them and a few like hard right members of the Football Lads Alliance and one of sort of a split from that. Yeah, the following week, Tommy Robinson came out and read the speech again. And there was about over 1,000 people there. So Tommy Robinson has thrown his weight behind this sort of Generation Identity. He's like been covering activity that they've done in Europe. He's got close to the leadership. So there's this far-right coalition that's been emerging of UKIP, Tommy Robinson, Generation Identity, and the Football Lads Alliance. And it's like all of these groups have been drawn together. And it's sparked by Selma getting banned from the UK. Then Lawrence Southern got banned. Then Tommy Robinson got kicked off Twitter. And there's just been a string of like incidents which have either been the state repressing the far-right or social media companies realising that like they don't need to give a platform to these fucking racists. And like all of this stuff has led to the far right developing this victim complex where they think that they're being persecuted for their fucking like racist views. So they called this Day for Freedom, which was this like this whole coalition came together. There was about 5,000 people on the streets where Tommy Robinson was like comparing the thing. It was his team that had organized it. Like Breitbart people were there, UKIP speakers, like other anti-Islam politicians. It was like the whole of the British far-right, like predominantly sort of anti-Muslim far-right. So not, there wasn't like an overt neo-Nazi presence there, but everybody else on the far-right was there. And that happened a week before, was it a week or 2 weeks? Before Tommy Robinson seemed to deliberately get himself arrested. Like, 'cause He was on a suspended sentence for contempt of court.
So just real quick. So, I mean, if we listen to the far right, Tommy Robinson was arrested for free speech, but he was arrested for contempt of court of recording with his smartphone inside of a trial. So I just want to make this clear, like, what happened. He wasn't, like, giving a speech in front of a bunch of people, and the police were like, down with his words.
Well, no, he was outside a court, live streaming a trial, or live streaming outside a trial that was ongoing. And he'd already had a suspended sentence for, like, filming inside courts, which is, like, a criminal offence. And he'd been told, if you ever do anything like this again, you're going to get sent to jail. So he turned up, like, during the context of this, like, far-right free speech campaign, doing something that he knew would get him sent to jail.
The judge had put a reporting restriction on the trial, and Tommy Robinson was aware that there was a reporting restriction on the trial.
Yeah, so he was basically reading out press reports from a time when there weren't reporting restrictions on it. So this is a grooming gang trial, which I think had been split into three different parts. And the judges had said, like, there's going to be no media coverage of the trial so that it can be fair, like, until all three bits are finished.
You said grooming gang? What is that exactly?
So it's like a group of, grooming gangs are groups of men and some women that sort of sexually abuse young children, like often like luring them in with drink and drugs. And it is a major problem in the UK, but the far right.
Pedophiles?
Yeah. So like gangs of pedophiles.
Jesus.
And the far right have tried to racialise it. Like, so the far right talk about Muslim grooming gangs. Like, even though there are, like, all white grooming gangs as well. Like, paedophilia is a problem that's endemic in British society. It's not something that's, like, solely done by one ethnic group. But
to one other ethnic group. And that's the other thing, is that they always paint the victims as always being, like, young white working class girls, and, yeah.
Yeah, it's this classic sort of fascist idea that right. The other is, like, a threat to your white children.
Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, he turned up outside this court, and knowing full well that by breaking this reporting restriction, the defence could argue that these alleged like paedophiles have not got a fair trial, and could ask for the case to be thrown out, or like a retrial could be reconvened.
So essentially,
essentially, like Tommy Robinson's actions could lead to an alleged group of paedophiles walking free. And
this is something that he can basically like do without any criticism from his fan base. Like they won't see this and go, oh shit, like he's been, you know, we've been like trying to advocate for, you know, these children in the face of these like rape gangs or whatever, but now he's just potentially like set a group of like rape gangs free. You know, they won't see that. They'll just completely, and now they see him as a political prisoner. And that's what's so disturbing, and that's what's so difficult, like in our kind of fight against them.
Well, yeah, they're so convinced that the British state is not doing anything about grooming gangs, even though these trials are happening. And it's like they're convinced that Tommy Robinson is the only person going around like exposing the scale of the problem. It's like, even though he's not actually exposing a gang, he's turning up at a trial and jeopardizing it. It's like that's not fucking like shining a light on the problem. It's like interfering in the state's justice system for trying to deal with this problem. But his supporters like have totally bought into that. Like, they're convinced that he's a political prisoner, when it looks more like he's done something to deliberately make himself look like a martyr.
Yeah, he's a self-obsessed wanker, not a political prisoner.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, it's somewhat different, but there is an element of similarity between, you know, all this stuff, and like, for instance, what's happening in the border in Tucson, where you have a bunch of like weirdo patriot militia types that are obsessed with the conspiracy theory that there was a cartel sex ring in the desert, even though everybody from ICE to even Alex Jones has said that that's fake, that it's a homeless encampment. But I mean, they're so set on, you know, saying that not only that that's real, but that the state needs to investigate it, even though the state did, and they said that there's nothing there. But if we can just continue forward, so Tommy goes to prison, and then how do we end up with 15,000 far-right people rioting?
I mean, one of the things that we've always said in London Anti-Fascist is that there is now a vast swathe of people that have bought into this kind of reactionary worldview, and that they can be called upon during things that are within the public eye. So, like, when Lee Rigby was murdered by two jihadists, they turned out, the EDL managed to turn out thousands of people when it was essentially a dying moribund movement. And we know that there are people that wouldn't necessarily be involved in, like, a structured far-right movement, but will turn out to big sort of things. The worrying thing is that they've repeatedly managed to get these large numbers now. It's not just like one event and then they fall away when people stop being interested in it. It feels like they're coalescing, and 15,000 people on the streets is the largest far-right movement that the UK's, the largest far-right street protest that the UK's ever seen. And that's something that should really be kind of a wake-up call for anti-fascists.
Yeah, like, all of this comes from Tommy Robinson's huge social media reach. He's got, like, hundreds of thousands of Facebook followers. He used to have hundreds of thousands of Twitter followers. And he's just been pushing this anti-Muslim message hard, like, built up a huge online fan base. And it's like he's never lost interest in street protests, like, ever since the EDL days. It's just, I think, like, he tried setting up another sort of UK branch of Pegida, which didn't work, but he's always been, like, dipping in and out of street protests. And it's just since this whole sort of far-right free speech campaign started, it's mobilised more and more people, and it's like they've been able to spin events as fitting the narrative, like, such as him going to jail. And that was just the spark for this, like, huge movement. There have been protests across the UK, like, there's been protests in Leeds, protests in Belfast, and these huge protests in London. So, like, 15,000 people is massive. Like, 500 of them went off and attacked the police and, like, started rioting.
What do you feel like the reaction to the rioting itself is on the far right? Because, I mean, obviously every time anarchists or anti-fascist riot or, you know, Black Lives Matter, quote-unquote, riots, I mean, there's like, oh, how could this be? This is the worst thing that's ever happened to society. So now that the right is engaging in street-level violence, what has the response been?
Well, the UKIP leader, this guy called Gerard Batten, he's come out and condemned the violence already. There have been some talk about it being unjustified, but, like, this is also, like, it's a movement based on the idea of violence. Right. It's like it wants structural violence to happen to minorities. Like, people in this movement have gone out and killed people. It's like there are dead people because of this, like, anti-Islam movement. So it's like the organisers haven't disavowed it.
Yeah.
Like, the way...
What's important to note is Tommy Robinson inspired a terror attack. Like, the guy who drove his van into a group of Muslims outside a mosque had his tweets printed out, cut out, pinned on the dashboard of the van that he used. Like, this is someone that has inspired more violence than anyone on the left has ever done. It's someone that's inspired, like, murders to happen.
Yeah, it follows the line of their argument that they're being repressed by the state. So, like, them, even people who might have before seen, like, this kind of, like rioting and, like, level of violence against the police is a bit like, oh, like, you know, I don't want anything to do with that. It might be more, what's the word? Understanding of it. Because it follows that line of logic that, like, oh, we're being repressed by the state, so, like, oh, it makes sense for them to, like, act out against the police on this demo who are, like, still trying to restrict our free speech.
I think I've even seen some far-right people quoting Martin Luther King saying riot is the language of the unheard, which is fucking wild.
Yeah.
I think they see it as righteous anger,
yeah,
like, manifesting itself. Like, they think they're justified.
I think the fear is that, you know, that then you just get also people that don't like the police that are maybe slightly sympathetic to the right to then get involved, which is, like, you know, then it becomes almost like a quasi, you know, street level and, you know, revolutionary movement.
Yeah, I think that could definitely happen. Like, that's a risk that it depends how this stuff plays out, because the next big thing is going to be the 14th of July. Which is the Saturday after Trump arrives in the UK. So on Friday the 13th, there are going to be massive protests against Trump. Hundreds of thousands of people are going to take to the streets to oppose him. And then the following day, there could be tens of thousands of far-right activists taking to the streets.
So how is the anti-fascist... I mean, this will be the last overarching question, but how is the anti-fascist movement in the UK and beyond going to not only move within Trump coming, but also deal with this burgeoning street-level pro-Tommy movement?
That's the big question.
I think, to be honest, what we've got to start doing is we've got to start coalition building. Like, we've got to start reaching out to people that are, like, our allies that aren't necessarily on the same page as us, but, like, will... Like, we need our own... Like, the British left can easily out-mobilise the far right, and it needs to realise that. We could easily put out 30,000 people onto the streets if we got all the disparate groups together on the same page and recognised this Tommy project for what it is. And we need to start building a coalition that's able to do that, if not only just to achieve equilibrium again, to make sure that the far right don't see themselves as on the front foot, that they can recognise that actually, like, there's a much bigger social movement, there's a much bigger labour movement out there that can, like, put it back in its place.
Yeah, I think this Free Tommy movement is going to become, if, like, Labour form the next government, it's going to become a huge problem, like, this sort of resurgent far-right. Like, they will try to undermine, like, any kind of, like, social democracy that they see happening, right?
Then it will be, like, these are the people that will be used against a potential future Corbyn government. They will be used by the international bourgeoisie to try and undermine any sort of form of resurgent social democracy that they see as a threat to their interests. I mean, we will see, like, but I don't think it's an overstatement to say we'll see, like, kind of a classical, like, far-right street movement trying to undermine, like, a progressive Labour government if there is a Labour government in the future.
Yeah, like, I don't think that should be a huge concern for us, in a sense that, like, I don't want to defend a fucking social democrat government. But a resurgent far-right is something that is a threat to everybody. Like, it's not just that they could undermine, like, a left-wing political party. It's, like, they could be used against migrants, they could be used against workers. Like, they're a threat to all of us. And it's, like, even people outside of that, like, Corbyn project need to be mobilising against, like, this far-right threat, because it's a threat beyond that.
No, I think, like, if you look historically at things like the social democratic kind of government that was set up in Spain, like, its demands weren't that radical. Like, they wanted to have a referendum on the monarchy and stuff, and the far right came out and undermined it. Like, I think historically anti-fascists have recognised the role that, like, social democratic projects have to play in, like, kind of the development of, like, labour movements, the development of working class strength. And, like, far-right movements have similarly, like, recognised that, and therefore have, like, undermined it, because they recognise that these things are often, like, stepping stones to greater kind of working class movements that can, like, actually demand more, like, revolutionary aims. Like, I think, like, as anti-fascists, we need to recognise that. I don't think we can, like, necessarily, like, discount it.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.